This is Extraordinary Lives, a podcast from Lad Bible where we speak to people with a unique story to tell. A warning that this episode contains content which you may find distressing. I'm Ben Powell Jones, and coming up in this episode...
I looked to the side of the cutter and she had a jar with things in it. Clitoris, labia module, everything that she has cut previously. I looked at it and I thought, I'm going to die. I was wearing gloves. I was wearing socks. I was absolutely terrified. And I remember I kept asking God, please save me. Please save me. I'll never do anything bad in my life. I thought I was going to get caught.
What do you think would have happened if you got caught trying to escape?
I wouldn't be sat here today.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Extraordinary Lives. I'm joined today by Shamsa. Shamsa, if you could give a brief introduction to yourself.
My name is Shamsa, also known as Shamsa Arawela. I am a survivor of female genital mutilation, and that's what we're going to talk about today. And I'm also an educator and a fabulous activist. I love it.
I like the fabulous bit.
Yes.
Really brings it to life.
Activism is fabulous.
Okay.
Yes.
Well, today we're going to talk about some very sensitive topics and some very dark topics.
Yeah.
And I just want to say to you up front that, you know, I'm learning here as well. So please do educate me and correct me if I ask anything in an insensitive way or if I use the wrong language or anything like that. More than happy to understand how to correctly talk about this topic.
Of course, I'll be honoured.
Okay, so at the beginning there, you mentioned female genital mutilation.
Yes.
Can you tell us what that is?
Female genital mutilation is a practice that has existed. It predates both Christianity and Islam. It is a procedure where a young girl has her genitals cut, ultimately. There are four types. Type one is the removal of the clitoris, either partly or fully. Type two is the removal of the clitoris and the labia minora. And in both type one and type two, they can also be sewn together. Type three is the most severe type of female genital mutilation. And it is when the clitoris, the labia and the labia majora is cut. And then the person is, the young girl is sewn together. And then sewing them shut, leaving small holes for urination and period flow. There's also type four, which includes pricking, burning, scrape, anything that damages or changes the female genitalia. So yeah, that is female genital mutilation.
And is that ever done? I mean, this sounds like a stupid question, but is that ever done for health reasons? Or what is the reason?
There is absolutely no health benefits to female genital mutilation at all. It is a cultural practice that is really, really harmful to the young girls who have experienced it. And from the age they undergo the procedure up to when, you know, they pass away, they are a lot, you know, older, they have, there's a lot of complications that is involved, a lot of which can cause serious health risks. Whether that be, you know, through pregnancy, the period, the just as simple as even urination can get really complicated and painful and difficult.
So why do people do it?
It is a cultural practice that has, you know, like I said, it predates both Islam and Christianity. So it is something that has existed at first. I believe they used to do it on mummies in Egypt after they have died. And then it was done to slave women in Egypt. And then it just became a widespread practice all over Africa, Asia, and the world, really.
Is it just tradition? Like, why do this thing to people?
There are many reasons. One of the reasons is religious, which is absolutely berserk. That's not true at all. Religion has nothing to do with it.
That people do it in the name of religion, but it doesn't call for... Right, I see.
Yes, they do it in the name of religion. Also, a lot of cultures do it because they're trying to prevent either rape, sexual harassment, or, you know, any type of sexual abuse. Others do it so that their daughter doesn't have sex before marriage. Mm-hmm. Some do it because, you know, your daughter is not going to be marriable if she does not have the procedure done.
Wow.
So there are many, many factors. Also, there's a financial factor. The cutters, that's their job. Mm. That's where they get money. So you can imagine it's going to be a very difficult practice to, you know, stop. Mm-hmm. It's not going to stop with a click of a mm-hmm. finger because mm-hmm. there are so many elements that are in play. And, you know, some people, it's become a social norm.
Yes, it's sure. That makes sense. Yes.
And when something is a social norm, you will not see, you know, unless someone tells you otherwise, you're going to accept it and you're going to be okay with it because...
Well, that,
you
know. That's a very good jumping off point to the next thing I wanted to ask, because you were born in Somalia, is that correct?
Yes.
Now, I want to be careful here because obviously this, we're going to talk about cultures and different, you know, different traditions and different things like that. And I just want to be careful that we talk fairly about different geographical locations and different cultures. But when you were growing up in Somalia, were you aware of this practice and were you aware that it was something that would happen to you eventually? Or did it happen to some people? Or did it happen to every girl and it was just a rite of passage? Like, what was your understanding of it as a child?
We were told about it at a very young age. I lived with my grandmother and 11 other siblings. We were all 12. We grew up in the same house. It was half girls and half boys. And all the girls who were older than us had already had it done. My aunties, my grandma, every single female I have ever come across growing up has had the procedure done. So the whole entire community, knowing that you're coming off, you know, that is coming up to that age where you're about to have it done.
And what age is that?
It can be from, I'll say 3.
Oh my God.
Till usually, for some people, it's 0 until.
Oh my God. I didn't realize
15.
Wow.
But
okay.
It can go up to the age of 21.
So I assumed it was more of a puberty thing. But
they do it before puberty.
Okay, right.
Yeah. Because I think then it would be a lot harder for the girl to accept it.
Yeah, sure.
You know?
So there was an awareness in the house with your aunties, sisters?
Yes. No, there was a massive awareness. And when it came down to when we were having it done, they slowly, you know, started telling us, oh, you're going to have Guditan. That's what they called it. And because we already heard it, and every girl that we asked prior was so happy about it.
Right.
It was as if it was false advertisement.
Yeah,
that's
sure,
what it was.
Yeah.
But it's almost done so that you are convinced beforehand that it's okay and it's something to look forward to and it's a rite of passage and, you know, you're going to become a woman. So we were really excited. Me and my siblings were as excited as we would have been if we were getting our ears pierced.
Wow. And you were 4?
I was 6.
6. Okay. So you and your siblings were varying in age, but you were 6.
Yes, I was 6.
And you were all going to get it done at the same time? Or
yes.
Right.
At the same time.
But why would some be older and some be younger going into that procedure? You know, you were 6 and then presumably some were a little bit older.
So my sister was 7.
Yeah.
And my cousin was 5.
Right.
So we were just a year older from each other. But again, as you can see, it is 5, 6.
They just decided everyone's ready now.
Yes.
Okay. So, do you mind telling us about it?
Of course. I remember we were playing, you know, being kids, and my grandma approached us and said, we're going to have Guditan. Then we got excited when we were told that I was going to have it done with my sister and my cousin. And we went willingly to my grandma's house where the cutter was waiting.
Oh, so it was just like, we're doing it now?
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it was maybe a day before we were told.
Okay.
So when we arrived at my grandma's house, there was a woman sat on a very, very small chair in the front yard of my auntie's house, but it was gated. So there were gates around it, but we don't have backyards, we have front yards.
Mm.
And we waited patiently. Me and my cousin, my sister sat together. And then my cousin was told to go first. And she skipped, you know, because she's a child and she was a lot younger than us. She went to the chair, and the moment she sat down and made contact with that chair, there was my grandma, my aunt, two aunties, an uncle, plus the cutter. I don't remember who else was there. And I remember the moment she sat down, adults were grabbing her limbs, her legs, her arms, and trying to, you know, each hold on to one and to keep her down. Me and my sister are looking at each other like, what is going on? Because that's not something that we expected. The procedure was never described to us.
Had they said to you, it'll hurt a little bit?
No.
Nothing?
Nothing.
So you just thought it was a purely positive experience. Okay.
Yeah. And then I remember the cutter taking something out, and it's one of those small double-sided razors. But we couldn't physically see the razor. So when she started cutting her genitalia, all we saw was blood and my cousin screaming at the top of her lung.
Oh my God.
And then they took a material and kind of to muffle her screams, they tied it behind her head so that they could focus on holding down her limbs. And I think what is really, really important for everyone to know is this was done without anesthetics. This was done without any painkillers. This was done outside a house, probably with the same razor that they used on somebody else before she turned up to the house. And when we saw that, being the person I was like, this is not going to happen to me. And me and my sister ran. We ran. And because we were children, there were so many people in the house. So they chased after us. They brought us back. And we had to sit there until she was sewn completely shut and still screaming in tears, you know, asking for help, pleading. And then I was told to go next. I refused. And bear in mind that chair that had blood and everything, it still stayed.
God.
We all got cut on the same chair. And then I was dragged to that seat because I refused to sit down peacefully. And because of the type of child I was, I would not rest. I did not, you know, allow it. I tried to almost levitate off the chair, but they held with all of their might and their force. They held me down, opened my legs.
Who is holding you at this point?
My family, my grandma,
the people
my
that
aunt.
You trust.
Yeah, yeah, pretty much. And she started cutting, and when the blade touched my skin, it was like nothing I've ever felt before. It was extremely, extremely painful. And again, I'm fighting, you know? So it was very difficult for them to, you know, they were struggling, holding me down. And then they put a cloth over my mouth because of the screaming. And I remember at some point, my whole entire body went into complete shock. I just went almost numb for a little bit. And I looked to the side of the cutter, and she had a jar with things in it. Obviously, now I know that what those bits are, clitoris, labia majora, everything that she has cut previously, because all of that didn't come from my cousin. I looked at it and I thought, I'm going to die. I genuinely thought I was going to die. The pain was so overwhelming. You don't know what to do as a child, and you just kind of freeze, but also fight and trying to scream, but you can't because, you know, your mouth is covered. And it was very, very painful. And then being sewn whilst you are fully awake is one experience that I don't think I will ever forget in my life. I sew things now. So just imagining doing that to a human being is the most inhumane thing ever. And to have experienced that myself, I don't even know how to describe it, to be honest with you. It's a needle constantly going, you know, through you until you are completely shut. And then they left a small hole where the urination, the urine hole is originally meant to be. And then they left another small hole where the vaginal opening is for period flow and penetration in the future. And as soon as they were done, they tied our legs together, with a cloth, and then picked us up because we weren't allowed to walk, put us down on the floor. And then we had to, unable to turn away, unable to walk, unable to run, I had to watch my sister get it done, me and my cousin. Once she was done, they also tied her legs, put her next to us. And then the most unusual thing is every culture does FGM differently. Mm-hmm. Some celebrate it, others is more forceful. In some cases, it's a hospital setting. So it varies. But in my case, I don't know whether they've done it because of the shock. I don't know the reason behind it, to be honest. But they slaughtered an animal prior and then they covered all of us in the blood. And we had to stand, and you know, Africa is really hot. So we had to stand, with our legs tied until we dried. And then once we dry, they washed the blood off us. And it's the most disgusting thing I have ever experienced. And bear in mind, the blood is touching the wound. That's just, the procedure that has just happened to you. It's just horrific. It's horrible, horrible, horrible. And then I especially remember wanting to urinate afterwards. And the stinging, the pain, and it didn't have anywhere to come out from, really. So it took a very, very long time for me to urinate, which meant a very, very long time right after the procedure. Mm. I had to, urinate, but it wasn't coming out properly, which meant longer pain. And we had our legs tied for a few weeks.
A few weeks?
A few weeks, yeah. We were taken to the toilet. We were carried everywhere. And then because they scared that the stitches will come off, and if they do, they would have to redo it.
Okay.
So because we were all afraid of having it redone, I think they made sure that none of the stitches came out. Eventually, when they did untie us, it was very difficult, as walking and running. You're a kid. You want to run around. You can't do that. It took a few good months for it to not heal fully, but heal enough for us to start playing and almost kind of forgot about it. I know it sounds really unusual, but because it was a social norm.
Yeah.
So it's like, if you complained, although we didn't, because by that point we were terrified of our families.
Yeah.
Me and my sister, I think, genuinely thought they were going to kill us because we thought this isn't normal. And from then on, I think there was a massive fear installed into us against our own family.
Well, so I wanted to ask about that, because what you've just described is utterly horrific. Yeah. Like, it's unbelievably awful.
Yeah.
How was it that people from your family could go through that and then be telling you it's a good thing afterwards?
Yeah. Because it's normal. It happened to them.
But you wouldn't have done that. You wouldn't have gone through that and then told other people, yeah, it's good, you should do it.
To be honest, I probably would have if I lived there.
Okay.
If I had lived, imagine you live in a place where, this procedure takes place, there is no way that you can disagree.
Yeah.
And their purpose of kind of making it sound nice is so that to kind of not traumatize the child. I know it sounds stupid, but they don't want to create fear. Mm. So the child can run away, they can go into hiding, they can refuse if they actually described it. So it was down to, the whole village, because it wasn't just up to my parents, my grandma. In terms of raising me, it was like more of a village raising you. And everyone in that village had a responsibility not to tell the truth, really, ultimately. I don't think there is anyone in that particular village that went uncircumcised, because it would be seen as shameful.
And was it quite a strict culture? Like, if you'd said that was a horrible thing to happen and I think we shouldn't do it anymore, would that have been something that was just impossible to verbalize?
Yeah, they wouldn't have listened.
Yeah.
They would have come up with the excuses, you know, it's religious reasons, it's to make you cleaner. And then what can you say to that as a young child?
Yeah,
you know, as an adult who's telling you this is good for you and, you know, there's a reason and there's a purpose. And it's, you know, for us especially, they said that it was a religious requirement. So we accepted it. And that's literally how easy it is for a child growing up in any country that performs FGM. They just agree and go along with their trusted family members until that trust is broken when the procedure takes place.
And you, at that point that you'd had it, you just said you were basically now terrified of your family.
Yeah,
naturally, so I think. Is that what led you to want to move away, or was that a different set of circumstances? Because I guess what I'm wondering is, at that point, what you're describing is, as a child, despite how utterly horrific it was, you were still in a position where you're going, okay, everyone's saying this is normal, so I guess this is life.
Yeah.
What was the point where you realized something was different?
It was when I came to this country.
And how did you come about moving to this country?
So my mom, at the time of my FGM procedure, she was actually against it because she had suffered so much complications. But my mother wasn't in the country. She was in Saudi and she was working towards getting us a visa to come to the UK. Knowing the risks of being in that country, she was, you know, kind of wanted to reunite all of us. I did not see my mom then since I was a baby. I was raised by my grandma. So when my mother came to get us, again, we didn't talk about it. I don't know whether she addressed that situation with my grandma, but we didn't talk about it because it's not something to, you know, we're told to talk about. It's actually considered ab, which means shameful to talk about.
Oh, right. So it's not just an open conversation thing.
No.
Right. Okay.
No, it's not an open conversation.
So your mother came back to Somalia to collect the children and bring them to the UK.
Yes. And we came.
What age were you here?
I had just turned 7.
Okay. So still young.
It's still young.
Yeah.
By then he had healed. And I remember we were in Ethiopia and I was still struggling to urinate. It was really, really painful. And again, we never, ever spoke about it. It was almost like it's done now. So, you know, what can we do? Because they didn't know there were any other options, you know, like surgery or things like that. So eventually my father was in this country. He successfully applied for our visa. It got accepted. And then we came to the UK. And we moved into London. And I remember coming here and thinking, you know, it was a whole new world. And when you're there, you're told so many things, negative mostly, about Western society.
Oh, right.
Yeah, like women are naked, you know, they are without faith, you know. You know, just things that they probably misinterpreted on TV.
So was that a bit scary for you moving here?
It was. I was terrified. I remember I drank, was it Coke or Pepsi for the first time? And I thought it was alcohol. I was like, no, I don't want it. But I remember my mom laughing her head off. And she's like, no, because I came from a very, very small village. They didn't have any of that. And it took quite a while for me to adjust. And then I believe 2 years later, I had my period. So I was 9 when I got my period. I felt like I was being tested. And when, again, that's another thing the Somali community do not talk about is periods. Especially with their daughters. We just find out the day that it comes. And then the majority of us think we're dying.
What? So there's no education?
No.
Mike, wow.
No, I genuinely thought I was dying.
Yeah.
And I remember my mom laughing and she's like, no, you're not dying. Don't worry. But I was told, she's shown how to use a pad, but I don't think my FGM was ever considered. Because again, they have lived what they consider a normal life, even though they've had FGM. So we should do that too. And my mother told me that I should never share it with anybody, the fact that I've had my period. Don't tell anyone. Not my father, not my sister, no one. So I had to
Why?
Keep... I don't know. It was, I think it's because you're considered a woman when you get your period. So I don't think she wanted anyone to consider me that way or suggest, you know, or because they suggest marriage quite young in some cases. So I don't know what she was afraid of for her to tell me that. She never told me the reason why. But I kept it to myself. I remember every single month for the next 3-4 years, I used to roll from one side of the room to the other because it was so painful. The period had absolutely nowhere to come out because you're completely shut. You know, you're left a tiny hole. There's not much blood that's going to flow, especially considering, you know, you're sewn together.
So does it come out, but just extremely slowly?
Extremely slowly. So it accumulates inside the woman. And for some women, it just doesn't come out. So every month it just accumulates and accumulates and accumulates and it dries, causing them quite a lot of... it can even cause infertility, cause many issues. I visited doctors almost every single month and I was examined almost every single month. I think for the first 2 years, I was never examined. They never examined my genitalia. They just put it down to stomach pain.
Okay.
So I thought, okay, you know, if they're saying that, then that's fine.
So your mother, because you were young, your mother or your parents were taking you to the doctor.
Yeah.
But they weren't saying...
No.
Potentially it might be
it
this.
It might be that, yeah.
No. It's quite strange that in a way, that they were willing to say, look, this is causing a problem, but then they wouldn't address...
Because I don't think they put that together.
Oh, I see, right.
I don't think, because this is what I mean. They don't... I don't think they necessarily believe that because they have never had that type of complication, then why is my child having that type of complication?
Right.
So they don't put two and two together.
Okay.
And when I was 14 years old, I started physically tearing because this is healed scar tissue now.
Okay.
So I started physically tearing from the bottom upwards. But only like a tiny, tiny bit. And urination became even more painful. Period pain became, you know, well, I think my period pain stayed the same. I can't say that it was worsened. But because of the stinging, the pain, that's a different type of pain. So you have the period pain, plus you have an unhealed wound.
Yeah.
You know, you have a ripping, plus you have to urinate every day. So it takes a very long time for it to physically heal, you know, given the fact that your body is very active. And I was taken again to a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I was taken to a female doctor who physically examined my genitalia. And she basically explained to my mother that because I have really sensitive skin, was tearing, it needed a way out, the blood, and it was started tearing through my skin. Because again, if you remember, I told you it was drying.
Yeah.
So it physically tore through my skin, opening it bit by bit every day. And then it would stop.
But did that doctor acknowledge the FGM then?
Yeah, they saw it. They just, they were like, oh, here's some painkillers. It's the period that's causing it.
So
that's it.
So do you think they knew what had happened to you?
Yeah.
Right. So they looked at it and you think they just thought, oh, that's just a culture. They understood it was a cultural thing that happened to some people and they were like, well, here's some painkillers.
Yeah.
Okay. Because just to be clear to anyone listening, FGM is illegal, isn't it?
It is illegal.
Yeah.
There's the Female Genital Mutilation Act of 2003.
Yeah.
I believe... I came in 2001. So even after it became illegal is when I was examined. But I don't think it was public knowledge
that it was
per se.
Okay.
I think it was just, you know, starting out as, you know, this massive concern.
Okay.
But even then, I was examined multiple times from the age of 14 onwards. But I remember before the tearing, I remember I was, because I think earlier you asked me, when did I know something was wrong? Mm-hmm. I was in year six and I sat down in a sex education lesson and I signed the permission form myself because I knew my mother wouldn't let me.
Oh, wow, really?
And I really wanted to be...
What, so you forged her signature because you wanted to understand... Right, okay, okay.
I wanted to understand what it was and because she was so adamant for me not to do it, I faked her. I knew her signature, so I just signed her name. And I sat in class and I remember them showing the male genitalia and the female. And then I looked at the female and I thought, I couldn't even care. I've never seen male genitalia. I did not care.
Yeah.
But the female one, I was so focused on that one. And even the fact that my teacher didn't pick that up or I was just so confused because it looked what it should look like. But for me, I was like, that's disgusting.
Yeah.
You know, why do you have all of them bits? I don't. You know, that's what we were what was considered dirty and unattractive or just not good. So I was like, every bad thing that was said about the Western world, I believed in that moment because I thought they're so unclean.
Right. So, so prior to that moment, had you thought that FGM happened here as well?
Yeah.
But then that moment you realized it hadn't.
Yeah.
And so for you, it was like, oh yeah, all the rumors are true. It's disgusting and dirty. Wow, okay, that's
and I was like, the females here are, you know, they must be disgusting and dirty and, you know, we're cleaner. And But then I quickly realized after high school, during high school, that FGM was a crime and that it should have never happened. And I think when I found that out, I realized... It's not that I realized, I think all the insecurities came flooding in, you know, knowing that this doesn't happen to everybody, knowing that this was wrong from the beginning. And even though as kids, we knew it was wrong because it was painful, you know, it wasn't fun. It wasn't something to be excited about. We were tricked. So you start going back in your mind and thinking, now that makes sense. Now this makes sense. Now this makes sense. But then it leaves us with, you know, resenting our family members, not being able to trust our family members, feeling abnormal in some cases.
And how did you find that out? When you say you left high school and you realized it was wrong and it was a crime, what was the trigger for finding that out?
I think, I really don't remember, but I think it was in high school, another young friend of mine also went through the same thing. But she came here when she was really, really young. So it happened to her when she was maybe 2-3 years old. So she was very open about it. I always kept, you know, I was told to keep my mouth shut, so I kept my mouth shut. But with her, she was so open. And I remember telling her, but isn't it a good thing? And she's like, no, it's not. They lie to us. This is not right. You should have never been done. It's not even an Islamic practice. And I think knowing that, I thought I felt so betrayed by my family.
Yeah.
I felt like now I'm not normal. Everybody else in my school was normal and I wasn't normal. And I didn't know who was circumcised. You know, I say circumcised because that's the term they use. But I didn't know who had FGM and who didn't. You know,
and
so
did you feel embarrassed?
So embarrassed. Yeah. I never told a teacher. I was so ashamed. And I just thought everyone is going to think you're damaged or, you know, because you were sealed shut. And when you face the reality of what a vagina actually looks like, you think, whoa, okay, mine does not look like that. Mm. And you start putting yourself down and within my family, they had a really bad habit of calling me a and a and I think it's just they didn't mean it.
Just to clarify, like, was it a kind of in a family jokes way or in a way that they actually were doing it as to put you down? And
I think it was to put me down, but it was more so a normal thing to say to girls.
Okay.
It just, you know, it just flows. It just comes out. So I don't think it was intentional. I think, you know, when they get frustrated or angry, they're like, oh, you know, whatever. But the way that we use those terminologies is more casual than insult.
Mm.
Obviously, coming to this country and being educated, we know now that that's an insult.
Mm.
You know, before it was like, oh, it's just something parents say. And one time I thought to myself, you know, as a teenager, is it because they thought that I was going to be that they cut me? Because quickly you start to realize that, you know, it's to prevent girls from sex outside marriage. Yeah. And I thought, did they think that I was going to do that? And that's why they did it. And I'm like, you know, it just really, really put my self-esteem was gone. Mm. I had lacked confidence. I had mood swings. And then I was labeled as a troublemaker.
Mm.
I wasn't learning like everybody else. I struggled with English and with reading.
I guess, because also at the point when you're a teenager is when you start to think about relationships as well, even at a very low level, gentle, subtle level. But that must have had a huge impact on you thinking about what if people find out if about that, you know, will I be able to date people?
Dating was not in my mind, to be honest. I did date, but it's not the, you know, the common, well, it could be, but my dating was speaking to them. Mm-hmm. I could never have someone physically touch me mm-hmm. like that in a sexual way mm-hmm. anyway, because in the back of my mind, I knew what was happening down there. So I just thought I didn't want anyone to find out my disgusting secret,
mm-hmm.
you know, and then it became my disgusting secret. So I didn't tell anyone, even the guys that I used to date back in high school and talk to and my friends and, you know, I didn't ever talk about it. Mm. I acted as if, you know, I am normal, knowing that, you know, that I had this procedure done and I was suffering in silence.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the only thing I knew how to do.
Okay. I know that there's another big part of your story as well, are you happy if we move on to that?
Of course.
Yeah, great. Do you feel like you've said everything you want to say about that period? Because we'll do a summary at the end.
Yes.
But is there anything else from that period that you think is important for people to know?
I think it's important for people to know that from the time I came to the UK up to when I left to go back to Somalia, the topic we're just about to discuss after, I have visited doctors multiple times. I have been examined multiple times and I've been sent home multiple times. And it was really disheartening to know that I didn't have the support of medical professionals in terms of, you know, defibrillation exists now, which is opening that wound up.
Okay.
But that was never an option for someone as young as myself. So we then saw that as you just want us to stay shut.
Yeah.
So you're okay with it as well. Because you examined me and you just sent me home.
Oh, well, you're right, yeah.
You know, so it felt like I was trapped in two different societies that I was a part of, but I wasn't allowed to be either one. You know, the Western world wanted me to come, you know, be more Western, and the Somalian one wanted to be more Somalian. So as you get lost in the middle.
What should they have done? For anyone watching, you know, we could have a doctor watching who looks at somebody who has a similar condition. What should that person do?
I think that you should really consider person-centered care. One, not all survivors are the same. Mm. Not two experiences are the same. So support that person in the way they want to be supported. Mm. Do not allow them to leave with the same discomfort that they came in with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, have a solution for them at hand. I know that defibrillation now is an option for people who are not pregnant, where before it was only for pregnant women.
Got you.
Which was quite shocking, to be honest with you. Why not help them before they get pregnant, you know? But now that that is an option, I think a lot, doctors and nurses, any professional that has a duty of care that comes across a survivor needs to do their job in providing the service that they came and asked you for. It's as simple as that, yeah.
Very clear and understandable.
I hope so.
It doesn't sound like rocket science, does it?
No, but it doesn't.
It's sort of amazing that that was never an option that was given to you, even for somebody to say, are you okay with all that? You know,
yeah.
Just to ask you if, yeah, okay. Okay, so let's move on to the next chapter.
Okay.
What age are you when you decided to go back to Somalia to reconnect?
I was 17.
17, okay. So did you finish sixth form or high school?
No, I didn't start. I started, but because of my insecurities and my doubts and my trauma, I was, again, like I said, I was labeled a bad child, someone who did not conform to, you know, the Somalian norms. So I knew of this culture that we have called Dakan Elis, and it means to reculture.
Ah, okay.
So because I used to hear it growing up, and I know siblings and cousins, not siblings, but cousins and relatives who were sent back to Somalia, I thought instead of them sending me back, let me, you know, offer that up and be a good child to my parents, you know, prove that I can be responsible and, you know, I want to get to know my country. And I was very naive, to say the least. I expected the best. I don't know why. But if you think about it, even though in Somalia, the FGM was really bad, that is the only, and something else happened. But the only two bad things happened to me in the whole time that I was there. Mm-hmm. So I remembered the good things, you know, the going to play with my siblings and being so free and climbing trees and causing trouble. It was very fun, you know, my siblings, cousins and all.
And I guess at that age, if you're a kind of teenager, you're looking for acceptance, aren't you?
Yeah.
If you feel different from where you are right now in the UK, you're going to think maybe I can find acceptance in the other place where I share my culture.
I was actually hoping that my family would accept me more.
Yeah.
If I, you know, said that I'm going to do this for them and, you know, for myself. And I went back to Somalia still thinking that I was that six-year-old kid and they're going to treat me the way that they treated me then. But I was a grown-ass woman. Mm. The treatment I didn't realize was going to be completely different to when I was a child. So I told my mother that's what I wanted to do. At first, she was really, really concerned because Al-Shabaab was there and they ruled majority of the country.
Just for anyone who might not know, can you explain who they, what they are?
Al-Shabaab is a terrorist organization quite similar to ISIS and Al-Qaeda. They are very, very dangerous and very, very, very ruthless. I don't know if I can say it, but I can't stand them. Mm-hmm. But when I left here and my mom was trying to explain that, I thought, my people can't do this. Mm. Again, I was so naive and I thought it was just the Western world that was trying to portray my country in this way. And I thought, no, nothing's going to happen to me. I'll be fine. I promise. So she agreed. I think majority of my family were very grateful that I had, you know, suggested Dakan Elis, the reculturing.
And was this, had you been, while you've been living in the UK and growing up in the UK, had you been going back for summers or visits? Or was this like a, so this was just a, like, after a decade away, coming back, reconnecting with the aunties and all those people?
The land, yep.
Wow, okay.
Yeah. And my mom booked our flight. We went to Dubai, spent 2 weeks there, bought me gifts. And then we went to Somalia, where I got dropped off. And then my mom came back to the UK along with my passport.
She took your passport back to the UK?
Yes.
Oh, why did she do that?
That's what happens with Dakan Elis. They take your passport.
Wow.
But with my mom, the reason that she gave, because I asked, is because one, I am very, very forgetful. I'm not going to lie to you.
Right,
I'm not going to sit here and lie. I am very, very forgetful. And she didn't want me to lose it in that country because anyone else can use it and to come, you know, in my place, because there was a terrorist organization there as well. If anyone had, you know, my passport, then that would also cause a risk to myself and here, and she would get into trouble. Mm. So I think she was trying to protect myself.
She'd keep it safe.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
That was the idea. And then I was handed over to my auntie, who's also called Shamsa. And I stayed with her for 3 months. But I remember the first 3 days, it was so surreal. You know, everything was so different to what I grew up in here. And I remember her coming up to me one day, and the girls were, you know, looked like they were going somewhere. I'm like, where's everyone going? And everyone seemed to have, you know, be going in the same direction. I'm like, where's everyone going? So they said, oh, there's something called Tashir. I was like, what's Tashir? And it basically means when Al-Shabaab decide to punish someone for a crime, everyone in that town has to come and watch.
Has to.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. And this is men, women, and children. And men were lined up on one side, women were lined up on the side, and my auntie begged me not to go. And I said, if you want me to believe that my people are capable of this, then I will go, because I used to see this on TV.
Yeah.
I need to see it with my own eyes. I wish I didn't go. I really wish I didn't go. I got there, and I don't know how, but I ended up in the front of the line because everyone was so scared. They were kind of like, ooh, pushing back. And they brought the man out, nailed him down. And then I found out that he was going to have his hand cut off. And they were men in wearing balaclavas, and they stretched out his hand, took a large machete, and they literally, I think with 3 cuts, they completely severed his hand.
Oh, God.
And then they took the middle finger whilst everybody's chanting Allahu Akbar and just waved it across. And these are little babies and little kids running around and watching this as well, teenagers, young people. And they waved it around across the men's section, and then they gave it to the women, and then the women waved it right past me and the other women. His mother was forced to watch as well.
Oh, God.
And she collapsed. And then they bought a jar that contained like boiling hot oil. And they took his hand that was just severed, and they put it in the oil, took it out quickly, and then he passed out.
His arm that was severed.
Yeah.
So they did not the severed hand, but his actual wrist.
The hand was severed, but the wrist that was bleeding.
To like cauterize it.
Yeah.
Like seal it or
almost. That's what it seemed like to me. And then they wrapped it really quickly. And then because he passed out, they kind of dragged him out of there. And I remember my cousin, whilst they were chanting Allahu Akbar, I was just in utter shock and disbelief. And she was like, you need to say it. And I said, what? And she goes, you need to say Allahu Akbar. I said, I will not say that, because I'm not using the name of God, especially one that I know is peaceful.
Mm.
And for this, I said, no, I'm not going to do that, because by then I've been educated on terrorism and also Islam. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And she goes, okay. So I kind of like moved my mouth so that they would think.
Because
she said to me, if I don't, then they can whip me. But they had this really long whip and guns and things. So they were like, they're going to either beat you up or whip you if you don't say it. So I started moving my mouth, went back to my auntie's house, and I cried. I was terrified of everyone, including my own family, because I thought, are you? Obviously they weren't, but when something is normal, it's everyone accepts it. So I didn't know who was who and what was what. But again, I trusted my auntie. This wasn't the FGM was my father's mother's side. So it was my father's side. Right. This particular family was my mother's side, who've never wronged me in their lives. So I trusted them.
But were you saying to them, that was awful? Or were you scared to express that you thought?
No, I told them.
Right.
One thing about me is I always express myself, unless I was in danger.
Okay.
But I was like, this is horrific. Why would they do this? And she was like, you need to stay low. You know, if they find out you're a British citizen, that can really harm you.
Oh, wow.
They can even kidnap you, because they were kidnapping girls at the time. So there were quite a lot of girls at risk. So I think 3 months into it, I get a call from my mom, and she's like, oh, my brother in another city wants to come visit you, and he wants to take you to that family. Because my mom didn't have any brothers and sisters that were the same mom and dad. So it's either from her mom's side or from her dad's side.
Got you.
And I was with my aunties from my mom's dad's side. And my uncle from my mom's side was coming to come pick me up. So he came and he was lovely at first, and he picked me up and he took me to a small city called Marka. The whole entire journey from where I lived, Bulubur, to Marka was it was a very long journey. I think it was 2 nights or something that. It was a very, very long journey, and it was by car. And we had to stay in different people's houses as a rest stop. And then I was taken to Marka, but again, during that journey, I was treated like a princess.
Right.
You know, I was given everything I asked for. I was being taken into farms, fruit farms, which are absolutely incredible. And I was just like, oh, you know, I'm so lucky to have a family. Although the place I lived was really dangerous, I thought, you know, I have a family that will help me explore, you know? And when we got there, things changed quite rapidly. I think everyone had their own plans in mind for my coming. And there was really horrible intentions behind him coming to pick me up.
Okay. So do you think that the intentions were there from the beginning?
Yeah.
It was planned.
Definitely.
Okay. Right. Well, let's get into that. You'd got there. Presumably at that point you were thinking, okay, this is good. This is nice. I've had this nice couple of days experience with the family. You arrive at this house, and then what's the point where you realize, okay, I'm not sure about this?
He comes to me one day and he's like,
your uncle, yes.
After being there for a week, he comes to me and he's like, Shamsa, you know, I really think it would be beneficial for you to think about marriage. And I said to him, you know, I have no intentions of getting married. That's not why I came here. That's not what I want to do. So I thought saying no would have been enough.
Yeah.
And at first he left it, and then he just continuously, almost every single day, just making small, small, small suggestions. And then the suggestions kind of turned into, you know, firm suggestions. It was a lot more firmer, and his tone has changed, and he became very, very scary to me. I saw red flags.
Wow.
And then he got a phone call one day, and he goes, Shamsa, come here. So he gives me the phone, and it's my auntie, his sister, who was in a city that I passed, and she never said two words to me. Mm-hmm. She knew I was there, never came to see me. And she goes, oh, you know, I would love to introduce you to my son. I want you to meet him, you know, and you so see if you guys like each other, you can get married. And again, I said to her,
on that first phone call.
Yeah. Okay. And I said no. But yeah, this is why I knew it was premeditated. I knew that there was a plan before he even got me. Mm-hmm. And I said, no, I'm not interested. So because it was so consistent, the ask of getting married, you know, get married, get married, get married. Then one day I went to him and I said, if you're so desperate for me to get married, because I got really scared at that point. I said, I was talking to someone I wasn't even talking to him really. He was a friend of mine, and he lived in my auntie's place where I was staying previously. So I suggested him. I was like, if you're going to force me to get married, at least, you know,
someone
I've met. I said him. He took the phone, and just for suggesting it, I got beaten the hell out of.
Oh,
he beat me up really bad.
And this is a grown man.
This is a grown ass man. Yeah.
Wow.
And I was 17 at the time.
And before that, had you seen any sign of physical abuse like that?
Just his tone changed before that, but he's never got physical with me. But because of the suggestion, it was like all his plans were falling apart because of my one suggestion. So the asking of for me to get married was not asking anymore. It was more threats, and it's going to happen.
And I suppose at that point, you've been driven 2 days away. It's not like you can just go, I'm going to fly home. You've got no passport.
Yeah.
No way of getting to the airport.
Yeah, no. I didn't even have a phone. He took my phone from at that point. So I had nothing.
Oh, wow.
And this didn't happen straight away. It was like weeks into it.
Yeah.
When by the time it got to a month of me being there, it turned into threats.
Yeah.
So one of the threats was Al-Shabaab, the terrorist organization, ruled Marka, that particular city. And because it was so small, it's in between mountains and water. So government decided not to invade because everyone in that small city would die. Mm. There's nowhere for people to escape. So one of his threats was, I'm going to call Al-Shabaab and I will get you locked up for being an Asi Waladin, which means someone who's bad to their parent. We're not allowed to talk back to our parents. That we are considered bad if we do, even if we're in the right. And in the prisons, the sentence is 3 months for that. And in those prisons, women tend to get sexually assaulted.
Right.
And when I heard about the things that go on in those prisons, because people have just volunteered this information to you, mm. I was terrified. And I thought, I can't, because I will die. They will kill me. Mm. And plus, I'm a British citizen. Yeah. So they will have a field day with that one. So I thought, okay, I need to minimize all of the, you know, big mouth that I have. I have to keep my true self in and just agree to everything they say from this point onwards.
Survival mode.
I was on survival mode. And then one day I got a call from my mom. He got a call from my mom. And because I didn't have a phone, access to a phone, he just said, oh, you know, you can call me and you can speak to her. And he sat me down, put the phone onto my mom, and she was like, oh, uncle told me that you wanted to get married. You found a nice boy. And they told him that it was his sister's son. And she was like, I've never met him, but he seems like a nice person. Obviously, this is anyone that my sister raised is good. I could not say anything because I knew if I did, once I got off the phone, he will beat the shit out of me.
Mm.
So I said, yeah. But in my 17-year-old mind, I was trying to find a way to escape. So I thought, just say yeah now. You know, then there's no risk to me being beaten. So I can try to devise a plan for me to escape. My mother bought me a camera. I sold it. My friends from London, two teenage girls, the same age as me, collected money to send to me. I think it was $100. But that wasn't enough to get out because there was absolutely no way out. If I went by car, there's checkpoints everywhere. One of my uncle's other threats was, I'm going to put your picture in every single checkpoint from there to the city where it was government controlled. So I was like, okay, I can't even leave because this man is, you know, threatening to take my photo and put it everywhere. I can't take a flight because there's no airport. Mm. I can't go sea because I can't swim.
Mm-hmm.
So I was trapped, to say that I was trapped is an understatement. One day I was in the toilet and I get a knock on the bathroom door and they're like, hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. So I quickly got dressed, came into the room. I was escorted into a room my uncle was in and there was some young man sat next to him. So I was told to sit down. There's a plate of food that I haven't seen. You know, this was the same type of presentation I had when I first arrived.
Yeah.
And he was like, oh, meet Hassan. Hassan was his name. Till this day, I don't know his last name. I'm not going to lie to you. I have never been told his last name, so I don't know. Even though his family, I don't know because, like I said, my mother's siblings are very... So we didn't know our cousins like that, especially back home. He introduces him and he says, this is the person I want you to get married to. And I was like, oh, whoa. And he explains, this is your auntie's son. So in my mind, I'm thinking, my first cousin, it's my blood.
Yeah.
And I said, I'm not interested in getting married. And I said that out loud. I said, I don't want to get married.
In front of the boy as well.
Yeah. I said, I don't want to get married. Because I thought maybe if I say that, then he would not want to do it as well. And then my uncle was like, oh, don't worry. Don't worry. You know, you'll come around. And I thought, okay, like this is actually getting serious now. Like,
Did getting married mean staying there forever in their houses?
Is either that or I think they had hoped that I would bring him here.
I see, right.
Because I carry a British passport and that's very valuable back in Somalia. So I just could not get over the fact that he bought this man from, you know, it was very far. It was like miles away from the city that I started with. So I thought, okay.
And when you say this man, how old was he?
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't tell you that part. The way that my uncle explained it is that he was actually 2 years younger than me.
Oh.
That's the way he explained
it. 15.
Yeah. But I know for a fact that there are a lot of Somali people who either have quite a lot of children. We don't keep track of birthdays.
Okay.
So I think it's a guessing game.
Right, right.
So when he said 2 years, because I'm pretty good at maths, even if that's the easiest maths ever. But in my mind, I just could not calculate what was happening. And then I said to him, 2 years younger than me. I said, no, like that's even worse.
Yeah.
You know, I said, no, no. But he was not 2 years younger than me. He, if anything, was older than me. He was huge. Like it made no sense. He was like a proper built man. You know, it just, I don't know. I can't really speak for his age. I didn't give birth to him, so I don't know. That's just what I was told. I continue saying no, 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 no. And then I get a few weeks later, after being threatened, being beaten, trying to, you know, find a way to escape. And my 17-year-old mind just could not figure a way out. No communication with the outside world. I didn't know how to contact the British embassy. I didn't even know whether they would help me or not. Mm-hmm. So I just, you know, I was just on survival mode every single day. And with Al-Shabaab, they terrified me enough for me to just be quiet because I did not want to end up dead. Mm-hmm. They've killed too many people by then. And then I get a call. I remember I was at my mom's best friend's house and I get a call from my father who was here in the UK. And he basically is congratulating me.
Oh, no.
On my marriage. And I'm like, what? And I was like, what do you mean? He goes, oh, you know, you're a married woman. And I'm like, how the fuck is that possible? You know, because I was waiting for the sheikh, the actual man who marries us, to call me.
Yeah.
So that I can say no. Again, I was waiting for someone to listen to my no. But I never got that call. I didn't even know that it was happening that day. They kept it from me. So when I got the call from my father, everything was already done. Even though that marriage under Islamic law is not a valid marriage.
But so there'd been no ceremony and you'd give...
No.
There was no consent.
After. And there was no consent, no. So the meher is like what you guys might consider the engagement.
Right.
But it's an actual marriage. There's no engagement. We don't do engagements and things like that. I was married off. And my father in that phone call said, what's his name? What's the boy's name? Who are his family? What are their names? What tribe is he? And I said to my father, so, you know, I didn't say it actually. I was like, you don't know his first name or last name? He's like, no. And it shocked me.
Yeah.
Bear in mind, I was so let down by my family because of the FGM. And then to have been let down by them again through beating and threats.
Yeah.
And now my own father had given me up as if I was just, you know, damaged goods. I thought there was a serious problem with me. Maybe they saw something that I did not see. And I hanged up the phone on him because I just could not process what was happening. But I wasn't even given a chance to process what was happening. I had women come to the house. They put me in a green dress. And this whole entire time, I was in a daze.
Yeah.
I was so confused as to what was happening. And I thought, this can't be real. This can't be real. This can't be real. And I remember after they put this white makeup on me, I looked like a ghost because it wasn't my foundation color.
Yeah.
And they put, you know, they did my hair, put so many pins in it. It hurt. At least I had something else to focus on. They put me in the back of a car. And this whole time, I haven't seen him. They put me in the back of a car, drove me around town. Everyone is singing and clapping and excited. And I'm just, you know, in a daze. I'm not, paying attention to my surroundings at all. I was just in a daze. And then they brought me back to the house, my uncle's house. There were women there. Everyone was dancing, drinking, eating. And I was just numb because I knew I was going to be locked in a bedroom with this man.
Oh, is that the next bit that's coming?
Yeah. I was absolutely numb. I felt sick to my stomach. I remember they presented me with so much clothes and fake jewelry, and the bed that they had bought was secondhand. All the clothes that was in front of me that were supposedly gifts was actually put in debt under my name. So it was my debt to pay off. So the whole entire motive, true motive came out, and that was money, to extort money from my mother.
Oh, God.
Because she lived in the UK and they didn't.
And so she was rich.
She was richer. Yeah. You know, money just falls out of the trees and comes out of walls, you know, without you prompting it. Once all of that was done, I was put into a room, and I remember the bed was facing a mirror. So they just lit. It was so surreal. It was as if I was carried. It didn't feel like I was walking. It felt like I was walking, but it felt as if I wasn't. Like I was
right, like floating.
I was being, you know, just I was floating in, but I was being guided in.
Can I ask a personal question at this point? Sorry to interrupt.
No worries.
I'm just because of the previous bit we've talked about with the FGM. Mm. Were you still a virgin at this point?
I was.
Yes,
so, I was. Although a lot of people had doubts, I was. Yeah.
Okay, because that. Presumably that must have been a frightening thing as well.
Yeah.
Because you didn't know how that was going to affect the marriage. Okay.
100%. But thank you for reminding me, because prior to me being put in that room, prior to the wedding, I think a week prior, I remember, because I knew how serious they were about the marriage, I thought, because Al-Shabaab is there, if they take my... do you know how I explained when I was 14, I was ripping?
Yes.
If they took that as me losing my virginity, okay. Then I would be stoned to death.
Oh, God.
So I was like, all right, that. I might as well, you know, tell her what happened so she can speak to my mom so I don't die, So I told my auntie, my uncle's wife. She called my mother. My mother explained. And I think without my mother's knowledge, she took me to a cutter. And I was there to be examined to see whether I was a virgin or not, because everyone had no faith in me. And when she checked, and she was like, yeah, she's still a virgin. Because again, the stitches were like that much, it came off. And then she looked at me and she goes, do you want me to stitch you back up? Oh. I said, hell no. Did you just confirmed for me I'm a virgin, right? I was like, thank you so much. I said, goodbye. Take care. Close my legs together, put my things on. And I walked out before they can even resuggest that. But I did ask, why would I do that? And she goes, for your husband. So he can rip me open. I said, no, thank you. So when I was put into the room, I had that conversation playing in my head. And I thought to myself, imagine if he thinks that I'm not a virgin. Yeah. Because some people don't have a hymen.
Yeah.
So I was like, what if? Even though she just confirmed it, I was like, but what if? And I remember I was facing a mirror and I was still trying to figure a way out. Mm-hmm. Even though there was no way out, I was now put into that room, I'm trapped. I still was trying to figure out how do I get out? How do I leave? And then he comes into the room and without saying, hi, are you okay? What's going on? He's wearing a material that they just wrap around. Yeah. So we call it ma'awis. He was wearing that. And he just came in and right in front of the mirror that I was looking at, because again, I was just daydreaming. He dropped it. And because of the type of person I am and the way that it happened, I didn't know whether to laugh or cry.
Okay.
And I say this all the time. I genuinely do not know which way to go, because I thought the way it happened, the way he did it, was so ridiculous. Like, it was like, I laugh at everything. So it was like, what the f***, almost. But then I thought, oh, I know exactly what he wants. What am I going to do? So him butt naked, I told him, can you please take this pin out of my head? Because, you know, I don't want to be touched with all of this on me. And then he's there taking up, because there were a lot of pins. So I was just trying to slowly act like, oh, I was trying to take my time, trying to give myself time to find out, to figure out a way to escape. But that was never going to happen. And once that was done, I thought to myself, whilst he was actually in the process of taking it off, I thought, Shamsu, you have two choices. At 18, actually, I need to stop saying I was 17. After I turned 18 is when they got married. And I thought to myself, you have two choices. Either be raped tonight or submit and just tell him to f*** off tomorrow. So I thought, okay, let me get it over and done with. And then when it started again, because of the FGM, I did not have defibrillation, which means I was still shut. On top of, you know, all the other pain and shit that I endured, I was terrified. But the pain was so overwhelming. My whole entire body hurt. And the stitches are slowly, you know, being ripped apart. And then said, stop, you know, I can't do it anymore. I couldn't breathe. Like, I was crying, I was in pain. And then the moment I think I tried to, you know, get him to stop, I was just pinned down, and he used all his force and his might. And then I was raped that night and three nights after that so I spent 7 days in that room. Because it's like your 7 days honeymoon. You can either leave to do your wudu, which is to get ready for prayer. You pray in your room, you eat in your room, you shower, you come back in your room. You don't leave at all.
God.
He can leave sometimes, but you can't leave.
Was he talking to you?
No, because I refused to speak.
Okay. And do you think he felt worried that you were upset, or you're just his now? So
yeah, okay. I was his property, basically. And then, so like I said, I spent 7 nights there. Out of the 7 nights, I was raped for four.
Right.
And then on the fourth day, I just could not take it anymore. And I said to him, if you touch me again, then I will kill you. Like, I will actually kill you. And I don't care whether I die. They could kill me if they want to. If you touch me, I will find something and I will hurt you. And I don't know why that scared him, but because of the amount of pain I was in, I was unable to urinate for 3 days. Actually, not for 3 days. I wasn't able to urinate for the period of time that I was in that marriage. And with him there. So what had happened is he caused so much internal trauma that it affected my urination. So I couldn't. Urine would not come out. It would come out a little bit and it would shoot back inside. So I used to like literally lay down on a dirty toilet, because we didn't have toilet seats and things like that. It's just a hole in the ground. I used to lay down because I was in that much pain. And they refused to give me any medical help because it costs money and, you know, they don't want to spend money. And once the 7 days was done, my uncle actually kicked us out of my grandma's house, and I used the money that I collected from the camera and the one that my friend sent me to rent a property. So I thought, that's my house. You know, I'm the boss, I'm the owner. Hey, no, you're not.
But he was in there with you.
Thinking, because he's the husband, he's the boss.
You've gone through this horrific process and you've now moved into a property with your husband that you're paying for, but he's ultimately the boss of. At what point did you think, okay, this has to end? How long had it been before you were like, I need to get out of here?
Oh my God, it's been months.
Oh, months?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
It was months before. I think when I had my breaking point was, on top of the rape, I was also being beaten.
By him?
So domestic violence, yeah. I was involved and it was brutal. So anytime I didn't do anything, I would be beaten. And the last time he beat me was so severe that I just could not, I did not care whether I lived or died anymore. And I called my mother and I said, is this what you wanted for me, for your family to abuse me, force me to get married? And now I didn't tell her about the rape because I wanted to wait until I saw her. I was scared she wouldn't believe me. I wanted to look her in the eye. But I told her that he was beating me, and my mother hates anybody laying a finger on us.
Yeah.
And she just could not comprehend it. And I said, your family will lie to you as they have done for the past few months. I said, if I die here, it's all of you's fault. And I think when she heard that, she did everything in her power to get me out. So because the family weren't listening and they were like, oh, you know, they're just a married couple, they'll be fine, da, 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 da. They were trying to justify it. My mom wasn't having any of it. So me and her hatched a plan for me to escape. And that plan was for me to catch a bus covered from head to toe and use my pain as a reason to be going to a hospital, but not go to the hospital, just take a car and leave. And I knew a woman who worked at the hospital who helped me previously because they wouldn't take me. So I said to her, if my family come at any time, it doesn't matter what time it is, just say she just left, then they would still think that I'm there. So they said, okay. She said, okay. I remember I got into the car and my auntie, the Shamsa, and the other one was waiting for me in Mogadishu. So by then my mom told them what had happened and she said, go and get my child. But they couldn't come to this side because it was terrorism. They were scared. So they had to wait on that side.
Oh, so your mom told them she's escaping, go and pick her up.
Yeah.
So you'd set off in the car in basically like, I guess,
it was a bus, full of people.
And were you wearing like a niqab or something?
Yeah, I was wearing a niqab. I was wearing a big hijab, which is like the big black cloth. I was wearing gloves. I was wearing socks. I was absolutely terrified. And I remember I kept asking God, please save me. Please save me. I'll never do anything bad in my life. You know, I just, please save me. And ultimately, actually, before I left, one of my uncles went right past the window. And I thought I was going to get caught.
What do you think would have happened if you got caught trying to escape?
I wouldn't be sat here today.
Wow.
I can tell you that. I would not be sat here today. And then once I got to Mogadishu, where my aunties were waiting for me, they took me to their house, but still I was so afraid of everyone.
Yeah.
Because I thought you guys would probably do the same if you had a chance. But I remember he actually called the small phone that I had. And he was like, my auntie picked up and he was like, who's this? And she said, Shamsa, because Shamsa is her name, just like me.
Yeah.
And he's like, he thought it was me he was talking to. And he's like, watch, when I find you, I'm going to put you in prison. You will not leave this country. I'll make sure of it. And my auntie was like, actually, Shamsa is not the person you're speaking to. You're speaking to her auntie, the person she was named after. And she goes, all of these empty threats of yours. She goes, well, how about stop behind it? Stop hiding behind Al-Shabaab. Well, he wasn't hiding behind Al-Shabaab, but they couldn't go there. So she said, why don't you come here and show us what you're capable of? And we'll show you what we are capable of. This is our daughter. You know, you messed up big time and now you want to threaten her. And she was like, if you step foot in Mogadishu, I will shoot you myself. And he was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I didn't know it was you. And he goes, but it was okay for you to talk to my niece like that. He never called after that. They knew that I had left successfully.
The uncles never called? Nothing?
No. I refused. Even if he had, I still wouldn't have ever spoken to him. I haven't till this day, to be honest. And then a few weeks later, I had my brother come to the country to bring me my passport and a flight ticket. But come to find out, nobody in my family, apart from my mother, wanted me to come back here.
Oh, God.
Each and every one of them. Let me just say, my mother was, the whole time I was there, she was diagnosed and she was suffering from a brain tumor.
Did you know this?
I didn't know. She told everyone to keep it from me because I'm an emotional person, and she didn't want me to go crazy because I had a attachment to her. Mm. So she didn't want me to, that's the word she used. She said, I don't want my daughter to lose her mind. So she's already under a lot of pressure. Leave her until she comes here. I was told whilst I was on the plane that my mother was dying and that she had stage 4 cancer.
Oh God.
Which meant that by the time I got back to the UK, my mother was in a coma. I left her healthy. I came back to her and on her deathbed. And this is the woman who for months on end was begging for someone to go and get me before she died. And she, I had a conversation with her one day and she said, if I die here, and I just thought she was just a mom thing. She goes, if I die here whilst you're there, I want you to know that you will also die there. And I was like, yeah, I know, because there's bombs and bullets flying over my head. So I just thought she was, you know, being just a worried parent. I didn't think that she quite literally meant that. So she did everything she could until she went into that coma to ensure my return.
And that was the second time, wasn't it? Because the first time was she brought you over from the, when you were a child.
From Somalia. It's the second time she saved me, yeah. So, okay, as you can imagine, I just went through something horrific and then to have to come back, I had to push all of that aside and now grieve for someone I have not seen for a year. And I thought, you know, I just kept thinking, I wish I knew, I wish I had known, I wish I had known. Because I blamed her quite a lot whilst I was there. So why is this happening to me? It's her family. Da, 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 da. But I didn't know that she was dealing with a brain tumor. And my mother died exactly 7 days after my return.
How did you get to where you are now? What was a turning point? What do you do now?
Now I am a educator. Mm. I am a public speaker. I've had the pleasure of working with different charities here in the UK in terms of honour-based violence as a whole, including FGM. I support survivors on a daily basis. You know, I also did a campaign with the mayor of London's office, and I would like to make some changes within the NHS in terms of offering us better support with the complications that we have to live through. It's not just end the practice, also support the survivors. You know, we're living with these mental health issues and these physical complications. Help us. You know, there should be something under the NHS that doesn't involve just opening you up, leaving your damaged, you know, damaged nerves and scar tissue. There should be a lot more available for us. You know, we shouldn't have to suffer. Mm-hmm. And I help to train Met police officers on the practice of FGM. I've been doing that for, I believe, 2 months. I did it twice now, and is one of the best experiences I have ever had. And it made me realize that quite a lot of people are not educated on the topic. Mm. They don't know what type of language to use when talking to survivors. They don't know how to approach it. They don't know whether they say we're trying to be culturally sensitive. Mm-hmm. Stop being culturally sensitive.
Okay.
If you want to ask a question, ask a question. You know, otherwise there is no avenue for you to learn if you don't ask the tough questions. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are people like me that can answer those tough questions, but you need to understand there are people that cannot. Mm-hmm. So you need to know who can and who can't, you know? But I also play a massive part in trying to end it within my community, because I don't want anyone ever going through anything that I have, not just the FGM, but everything else.
Understandably. Mm. And when you look back over your life, which is, I mean, you've got some, in terms of me talking to you, your experiences are unbelievable, but sadly, it sounds like there's lots of people that will have shared your experiences in the world. But when you look back over your life so far, you're still young. What's something you think you've learned?
I learned never to silence my voice ever again. I think I found so much peace in, one, I removed myself completely from that toxic environment that I was in. which gave me enough room to grow, to have ambitions, to have dreams, to reprogram my mind so that I'm able to raise my daughter in a healthy, happy environment so she doesn't ever have to go through any of the insecurities, any of the abuse that I went through. My daughter is very well aware of what FGM is. She actually helps me educate people, other people, like her school, for example. So she's very proud of me, and I'm so, so proud of her. But being a mom now, it made me realize, yo, like, it's really not that hard to be kind. You know, you did not have to do any of that.
Well, what is amazing about you genuinely is you're one of the people that broke the cycle, because when you were talking about the start of it, you're talking of generations of people in the same cycle.
Never ending,
Never ending cycle. And you're one of the people that has broken it, and your daughter won't enter a cycle like that. You're an amazing storyteller. I mean, it makes my job so easy. I just sit here going, oh, wow, oh, wow.
Because if I don't do it that way, then I'll cry, and who wants that?
Well, that's the thing. You tell it in a very engaging way, despite the fact that it's a very, very difficult topic to listen to.
Because I don't like it triggering me. It'll trigger me if I don't laugh.
Okay.
So it's my happy place.
You're a genuinely amazing and inspirational person.
And thank you.
I'm so honoured to sit here and talk to you today, and really do wish you all the best, Shamsa.
Thank you. I wish me too all the best after the life I've had.
I know.
You said earlier I was young. I don't feel young.
How old are you?
I'm like in my maybe 60s. 80s.
Oh, you feel like you're in your 60s. Okay.
80s. Maybe 80s.
Yeah, you've had a
lot. But I'm 30. I turned 30 this week, actually.
Oh, happy birthday.
Thank you.
Wow.
Thank you.
Brilliant.